We've seen the image of a half-empty Lake Powell and the now iconic bathtub ring around its rim. We've heard the stories coming out of California about wells running dry. We've learned a new term, sprinkler shaming. We know enough to know we're in a drought, but what does that mean? What exactly is drought? What should we do about it? And why should we even care? I'm Jennifer Pemberton on The Source today, what we talk about when we talk about drought. Every Tuesday from the National Drought Mitigation Center. It has a map you may have seen in your Facebook or Twitter feed. Or maybe if you're not the kind of person who gets an email every week from the National Drought Mitigation Center, your social media feeds probably don't look like mine. Anyway, the email is the distribution of the weekly U.S. Drought Monitor. It's a map of the U.S. Normal areas of the country are white, and then places experiencing drought are colored yellow to a pretty intense maroon red. Yellow means abnormally dry. Two shades of orange are moderate and severe drought. Red is extreme drought, and the maroon color that covers most of California right now is for exceptional drought. It's a compelling map. That deep red color just makes it look so inhospitable in parts of the West. Hellish, really. Earlier this month, when I got the drought monitor in my email, I hit respond and asked whoever was on the other end of the email account if I could talk to someone about how they make the map and why. Because every week I take note of where drought is occurring. And that's about it. It's pretty pointless when you think about it. I mean, what am I supposed to do about it? The woman on the other end of the email account gave me the number of climatologist Brian Fuchs. Have you ever done a radio interview before?
Oh, hundreds.
Hundreds?
Yes, oh, we do a lot of interviews with the media here.
Good, so you're the guy.
Yeah, I should be able to get through your questions.
Fuchs works at the National Drought Mitigation Center in Lincoln, Nebraska. He's part of a rotating cast of characters who put together the drought monitor each week. Turns out it's a ton of work, so they take turns working on the map for 2 weeks at a time.
The product is not just from the National Drought Mitigation Center. It is a joint project that we do with USDA and NOAA. And within that cooperation and coordination that we have, there are 11 authors for the U.S. Drought Monitor. And two of them are here at the National Drought Mitigation Center, and the rest are within NOAA and USDA. What that means is we rotate the responsibility of doing the actual map every 2 weeks. And so I just recently did the map here at the beginning of July. I did my two-week shift, and then I passed it on to the next author. And the reason being is that there is a lot of information that we need to put together to get that weekly map out. So how did the map start is back in 1999, there was actually a fairly significant drought taking place in the Mid-Atlantic region and impacting Washington, D.C. And a lot of the federal decision makers and the federal government wanted to know, well, why are we seeing a drought like this? How bad is it? Have we seen it before? And there had been some previous work being done by a scientist here at the Drought Mitigation Center, Mark Sabota, and a scientist with the Climate Prediction Center within NOAA, Doug LeCompte, and they actually got together out in Washington, D.C. They sat themselves in a room for a few days, and they came up with what would turn into the U.S. Drought Monitor map. And so in the spring of 1999, the first prototypes came out, and it has been a weekly product ever since.
The reason that Brian Fuchs has done hundreds of radio interviews is because the Drought Mitigation Center does a lot of outreach. Fuchs is a climatologist, and he does scientific research, but he also educates the public through things like the Drought Monitor, and he acts as a liaison between climate science and policymakers.
We have politicians that call up, and just this last year had a senator from California get in touch with us because I'm sure he was hearing from his constituents about the drought situation and just needed more information. And so we deal with a lot of staffers out in Washington, D.C. We deal with a lot of people within USDA and NOAA that are feeding this information out to their field offices. And we have a fairly large umbrella. And that doesn't even touch on to the international work we do. With the success that we've seen with the U.S. Drought Monitor, we've had numerous countries come to study with us and train with us here in Lincoln at the Drought Mitigation Center. They've wanted to try to emulate what we're doing and take it back home to their own countries and try to establish something similar to a drought monitor map for their home countries as well.
What I really wanted to know about the Drought Monitor was kind of an unfair question to ask a scientist. What am I supposed to do with this information? I asked Brian Fuchs and expected him to say something like, "That's not my problem," or "I'm just the messenger." But he didn't. He answered like a good scientist by reminding me what drought is.
Drought is a natural disaster that is very slow to develop and very slow to improve or go away. It's not like a flood. It's not like a tornado or an earthquake or a hurricane that it happens immediately. You can assess the damage, start repairing, recovery, and go on. And that's what makes drought very unique, is it is a lingering type of natural disaster. So when people see that they are either coming into a drought, or even if they're still, the moisture and precipitation has returned and they see them as still being classified as drought, it's still telling everyone in the public that there are problems and we need to be cognitive of those problems and we need to do our best to conserve water. When it comes down to it at the very end, it's always about having enough water, having enough available water for all the different needs, and that includes human consumption, the natural ecosystems, businesses, manufacturing, agriculture. In some parts of the country, it also incorporates the need for what it's going to do for power supply and power consumption because of the hydroelectric concerns based on water availability as well. So a lot goes into these considerations. And when we look at the map, you're right, the color coding does try to bring attention to the worst areas with the reds and the maroons. And when you're looking at that map and you see those reds, that's about a 1 in 20, 25 year type of a drought event. And the maroons, that exceptional default, that's about a 1 in 50 type of drought event. So when you do see those, it is a significant event, and it is something that most people have never even encountered in their lifetime because of the severity of it.
Basically, what he's saying is that drought happens. It's a natural disaster, which is both natural and a disaster. Drought has major implications, and knowing you're in a drought is important. Conserving water when supplies are down is important. But we can't do anything to prevent drought or make it go away faster. We should know what we're supposed to do while we're in it, though, to help mitigate the impacts. The driest parts of Utah right now are orange on the drought monitor map. Tooele County and parts of Box Elder, Davis, and Utah counties are in severe drought right now. And there isn't a magic formula for coming up with what color to paint a county with. There is a lot of science and a lot of numbers, but there's also a little bit of art, or maybe just some subjectivity to the map. Drought doesn't just mean a lack of rain. It's not measured in millimeters of precipitation. The impacts of that lack of water are taken into consideration, too.
What's happening because of the dryness? Are we seeing reduced flows in our rivers and streams? Are we seeing the lack of water for full irrigation allotments? Are we seeing our reservoirs go down? Are we seeing our groundwaters decline? And so those impacts can tell just as much of the story as the numerical weather and climate data that we do look at and the hydrological data that we look at in assessing and classifying drought each week.
I'm kind of hung up on this definition of drought as a natural disaster. Is drought bad, or is it something that just happens? Is drought only something that happens to humans? Like, if a drought fell in a forest and no farmer was around to experience it, would it still be a drought? Brian Fuchs doesn't love my jokes, but he doesn't have a problem with answering that drought is both. It's a natural thing that happens despite us, and it's a disaster that happens to us.
Drought is a natural part of the climate, just like floods are. You will have periods where you have average precipitation, you'll have periods where you have above average, you'll have periods where you have below average. And part of that will feed into how the typical climate is of a region. And so, drought as a disaster can be something that is very short-lived. 2012, we had a drought in the Corn Belt of the country where it developed quite rapidly in late May, early June, and by the end of summer, it was a full-blown extreme and exceptional drought on the U.S. Drought Monitor. And then by the fall of 2012, conditions turned around again, and we started seeing improvement. And by the spring of 2013, there wasn't much drought left in the region at all. On the flip side of that, you do have what we've seen out in the western U.S., specifically over California and Nevada, that they're in their fourth year of drought. We're going to typically have to wait until the fall and winter to see how good the winter precipitation is going to be to try to start improving some of these conditions and making up some of the deficits that have been encountered over time. So, yes, drought definitely can be a disaster, and it is part of the regular climate of a region. And like I mentioned earlier, no area is immune to drought.
Oh, and climatologists can't predict when a drought will end, by the way. They can sometimes see one coming, but they don't know when it will end. I still find it strange that the drought monitor comes from a place called the National Drought Mitigation Center. But mitigation doesn't imply prevention. It does imply reduction, though. We can't prevent drought. We just can't. But we can be prepared. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, defines mitigation as the effort to reduce loss of life and property by lessening the impact of disasters. Mitigation, they say on their website, is taking action now, before the next disaster, to reduce human and financial consequences later. It's easy to think about this in terms of something like a flood. In fact, FEMA offers worksheets that cover floods, tornadoes, wildfires, tsunamis, even dam breaches, but nothing for drought. But there is such a thing as drought preparedness. It's harder in a lot of ways, and the National Drought Mitigation Center doesn't have all the answers. But they do focus heavily on information and data collection as the best way to watch what's happening with the climate. One thing about drought is that it doesn't sneak up on you. It's not like an earthquake. Hence the drought monitor, hence their work with policymakers, hence Brian Fuchs taking the time for lengthy phone calls with reporters repeatedly asking, "What is drought again?"
Well, hopefully I've answered all your questions, and if you do want to follow up with anything or expand on anything, you can let me know and I'd gladly speak with you again. You have a good day, Jennifer.
All right. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
So the National Drought Mitigation Center's definition of drought has everything to do with the impacts of drought and how to prepare for those impacts. There's also straight-up meteorological drought, measured by the amount of precipitation. To learn more about this more precise definition, I talked to Robert Gillies about the Utah Climate Center's research on drought.
If we focus in on the meteorological drought, okay, then you get what we would call the normal precipitation for the month, which is essentially a 30-year average, okay? And technically, if you're above that, you're wet on any particular month of any year, and if you're below that, you're dry.
Okay? So there's no normal? Or there's one, maybe one value for normal?
Well, the thing is, I don't like the term normal or average, especially with respect to the West, because we have a great degree of variability both in our precipitation and temperature. And so you can actually have, you know, real extremes in one year and not so real extremes in another year, but you still have the same average, okay, if you average it over a length of time. So it's really the variability that you want to look at rather than, you know, a 30-year average. Okay, but for simplicity's sake, okay, we go with, you know, above normal or below normal in terms of precipitation, and the same thing applies to temperature. So drought is essentially a function of how much rainfall you get and how hot it is, because the heat drives the moisture from the soil. So you may get a lot of precipitation, but if it's really, really hot, then you'll evaporate most of that moisture from the soil where you really need it. So that's where it comes into agricultural drought, okay, because in terms of what's happening in agriculture, you're losing that soil moisture. So many drought indices will actually factor in soil moisture into their calculation.
So I know agriculturally, there are a couple of counties in Utah that are categorized as drought, or even I think USDA calls it drought disaster areas. So county by county, they get designated. So meteorologically, can we say that we're in a drought? And do we say that for the year or for the season or for a 5-year period or that 30-year period?
You can break it down any way you want. Obviously, the number of years where you're technically below normal matters, okay, because the storage capacity that you have, for example, goes down. So if you have, say, 4 or 5 years where you don't have much snowfall, okay, and remember that snowfall is our major resource for water here in Utah, then the aquifers get, you know, they deplete. And so you have less moisture that you can sort of, you know, bring to the surface to irrigate. And so we really call that groundwater drought. And I think that's actually much more significant. If you have good reservoirs of water, then you can... You're able to cope with, you know, the fact that you don't get, say, a lot of precipitation in your growing season, so you irrigate, right? But if that water in the ground depletes over a length of time, say 6 or 7 years, then your resource or your resiliency or capability to deal with depleting water resources means drought for you.
I've been really irritated with people throwing around the phrase, the drought. Maybe you have been too. What, I mean, with all of these definitions of drought sort of rolling around, and drought by county and drought by state and drought by country, I mean, what do people mean by that word, and should they stop using it, or should they qualify it? Or,
well, I like to say drought conditions, right, rather than the drought. As an example, our monthly newsletter in North Logan from the mayor asked us to reduce our water consumption by 15%. In the 17 years that I've lived here, that's the first time that I have read that, or that has been the case. So that's significant, because what it's really saying is that the groundwater resources are now down, or are going down to a point whereby the consumptive use by the population can't be maintained at the level that we've done in the past.
Is that a data-driven message, do you think? Or is it just that everybody's talking about water shortage this year? I mean, is it, why this year, I guess?
Why this year? Probably because it's getting to a critical point. And if your water supply is decreasing from whatever perspective it may be, meteorological or otherwise, then of course, you know, you have to plan for that.
I think it's important to talk about climate in sort of these relative terms or in comparative terms. So I'm interested in the long view of Utah. Driest period, wettest period, sort of what do we know historically about the climate in Utah, and kind of how does what's happening right now compare?
So we get into the field of, you know, paleoclimate when we start to look at the past in the past 700 years. And there are many ways to do that. The Utah Climate Center and various faculty at USU have actually looked at tree rings. And people probably realize that in wet years, you have large tree rings and the opposite when it's a dry year. So if you actually look at that data in the past, you see there's a great deal of variability, but you also see there's been lots of times when there have been droughts. In other words, it's been very dry, okay, in terms of the amount of precipitation that you get. Let's go and think about really what climate is. Climate is the fact that it's very warm at the equator and that it's very cold at the poles, right? So there's a exchange of energy between the equator and the poles to equilibrate everything out to make it all equal. And of course, our planet is covered by 2/3 water. So the major way that energy exchange occurs is actually through water and the phase changes of water. When water goes from liquid to gas or liquid to solid, there's an energy exchange. So water is key. The oceans are key. So when we look at Utah, we are driven by what happens in the Western Pacific in particular, the water conditions there, if they're too warm or too cold or whatever. And these we call oscillations or cycles. And the most famous one from the perspective of everyone here in the West is the ENSO cycle, which is the El Niño-La Niña. And that affects southern Utah. And so we're moving into quite a strong El Nino now. Hasn't been the case for the last 5-6 years. It's actually been neutral, which is quite unusual. And so now we would expect that southern Utah will start to see significant developments with respect to precipitation. It should get wetter, okay, if El Nino is really the driver there. In northern Utah, it's different. El Nino or the ENSO signal does not matter as much. But then I've only given you the most famous of the cycles, right? There are other cycles which actually the Utah Climate Center has been a forefront in you know, researching. One has a very fancy name. It's called the quasi-decadal oscillation.
It's one of my favorite words.
Is it your favorite words? Yeah. So you know that quasi means roughly and decadal means 10 years. So it, roughly every 10 years, we have this particular cycle that has 6 years roughly of wet and 6 years of dry.
That my next question was, are there cycles?
Which and of course there are.
The answer is yes, many. Yeah. Many, many cycles. Brian Fuchs told me that you can sort of predict when drought is coming, but you can't really tell when that period is going to end. So it seems like by watching the cycles, you can sort of see when we're headed into a drier period. But it sounds like, you know, if you know where you are in these cycles, then you might kind of know when relief is coming, I guess.
Brian is right in one respect, but it's not the whole story, I don't think. The prediction for the West is much harder than, say, for the central US or for eastern US. And that's because, as I mentioned last time, this word variability. We have a high degree of variability, and you really see that in the climate data compared to the other regions of the US, either be central or eastern. So it is actually quite difficult to predict that, you know, you're necessarily going to come into a drought or not. But the cycles give you added information. But also remember that climate change is changing the face of drought, okay? If you actually look at the data, the last 100 years in Utah has been wet compared to the past. Now, the interesting thing in my mind, is that a climate change signal? You know, when you actually look at northern Utah, we're getting more precipitation rather than less precipitation over time, over the last 50 years for sure, but more of it's coming as rain rather than snow. So that changes the whole hydrological perspective of the way we store our precipitation.
Right. So it doesn't change the numbers necessarily, but it changes everything.
It changes everything. And so we have to be aware of that, not just for the recreational industry, but for every industry, for that matter, including agriculture. But, you know, we're getting better and better at the seasonal predictions. And the reason for that is understanding what drives these cycles. So here's a prediction for you. Okay.
Yes.
Technically, according to the QDO, we're coming out of the dry phase and should be moving into the wet phase. Now, that doesn't mean to say that it's like a switch and it will suddenly switch on in 2017. Okay. It may take, you know, a couple of years before you start to get into that wet phase. But the other thing that people should realize is that, again, it doesn't mean that it's going to be wet every single year over that 6 years. It's predominantly going to be wet, but you could still have a dry year. And that's always what catches people. They think, aha.
Robert Gillies was wrong.
He was wrong. Whereas in reality, if you look at the trend, I would be right. So fingers crossed. If I don't get it right, Jennifer, I'm going back to Scotland where I know it will be wet.
That's right. Robert Gillies, he is our state climatologist and a climatologist with the Utah Climate Center. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, as always.
Who wants to be right? Does the rain is better when something is wrong?
Support for this program comes from Utah State University celebrating the 2015 Year of Water, water expertise at its source, and from iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education. More about drought after a short break. This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Since not everyone is checking the drought monitor each week, do most Utahns know that we're in a drought? How do they know? And do they care? Lucky for me, someone here in Logan has some pretty good answers to those questions, straight from the mouths of Utahns.
I'm Courtney Flint, and I am a faculty member in the Department of Sociology, Social Work, and Anthropology at Utah State University. I'm a natural resource sociologist.
I think that phrase, natural resource sociology, is a little bit confusing to people. How do you explain that?
Sure. I think that folks like me, we really look at how people relate to natural resources in their environment and kind of bring the social and human dimensions of our environmental issues right up with the biophysical science. So we work in with a lot of other folks, but we bring that social perspective on natural resource issues.
And so last year, I don't know if it was you or your graduate students, somebody went door to door in some counties in Utah and asked some pretty detailed questions about people, what they're doing with water. So can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, I was one of those street soldiers last summer. So we undertook a really large water survey across three valleys in Utah to really try to understand these human relationships with water in neighborhoods, in households, across some different places in the more of the urban parts of our state. And so we reached out to over 4,000 households across 23 different neighborhoods and heard from an average of, over 60% of those folks. So we have a data set of 2,300 plus surveys that give us lots of information about what people are thinking about and doing with regards to water. So, yeah, it was an interesting methodology. We had a great army of students, great people who went out and went to randomly sampled households within these 23 neighborhoods and tried to make connections with folks and ask them to commit to doing this survey, a big survey, 16 pages of questions, with arrangements to come back a day or two or three later to pick it up from them. And it worked really well. I think it's an innovative methodology, and we get much better response rates than other kinds of survey methods.
So what kinds of questions were on that survey?
Yeah, we were really asking a lot of people about how they use water indoors, as well as some extensive questions about their outdoor water use, but also just some of their thoughts or perspectives about water, both locally in their communities and in their valleys, but also statewide. Some of their concerns, perhaps, and their thoughts about water. And then a whole lot of information about policies, too. What do they think the best strategy should be? What do they support or oppose with regard to managing water?
So 16 pages each times 2,300 surveys. It probably takes a while to read through that data, but it seems like you've gone through quite a bit of it. So what have been some of the – what are you learning? I mean, what is all of that massive data set sort of showing?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think there's like over 500,000 initial data points, and then we, you know, slice and dice it every which way from, you know, here to Christmas. But we're really learning that people have a strong consciousness about water. They're thinking about water. It's important to them. When we look at sort of concerns about water issues, they take a slight back seat to other concerns like air pollution and traffic and population growth and loss of open space that are top the list of concerns. But the high cost of water and water shortages are still a concern for over 70% of folks. And so those are water supply, water shortage concerns are important to people.
So we have heard some messages come from the governor's office and the state division of water resources about conserving water. I mean, you can go online and see if it's a, you know, if you need to water your lawn or not. And there is some information coming out. So we do sort of know that conservation is important, even just in the summertime, if not, you know, in a particularly dry year. But what do Utahns sort of understand about conserving water, or are they motivated to conserve water?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think as you think about whether or not folks thought that there was enough current supply to meet the state's needs, about 40% didn't agree with that statement. But when you push it into the future, over half, 57%, said they thought water supply is not likely to be adequate for the future needs of the state. So it's on people's minds, for sure. It's not off the charts, you know, everybody, but there are certainly some concerns. And more than half of respondents thought they could do more to conserve water, but many more thought they could conserve indoor water than outdoor water. You know, over half thought there's more they can do to conserve water inside their homes, fewer thought that they could do more outside, less than 30%. So there's some different things going on there. You know, in terms of water shortage concern, in terms of the factors that influence whether or not people will conserve or won't conserve water, that analysis has not yet been done. We're still waiting through all of those data. But I can tell you that the folks that are a little bit older, actually more women, those who are non-white, those that are lower incomes, recreate more. Those are folks that are likely to be more concerned about water supply. So we are starting to understand some of the demographics that go along with these data about water concerns, too.
Wow.
It's kind of interesting.
I know better than to ask why right at this stage, but those are really interesting.
Yeah, that's
subsets.
A complicated question.
People are concerned about water supply, or, you know, half of the people that you talk to were concerned about it or don't think there's enough. Do Utahns sort of know where their water is going? So the state water supply that they're concerned about, do they understand where that water is going?
It was interesting. We asked them about, you know, whether too much water was used by a couple of different sectors. And interestingly, folks really responded that they thought that residential lawns used too much water. Over half of the respondents said that, followed by parks and golf courses, and then considerably lower industry, and then only 10% of our respondents thought that too much water was used by agriculture. Interestingly enough, the reality of how our water is used in Utah is really the exact reverse of this. I think about 80% or more of our water is used by agriculture. So, but they may be aware of that, but they're not necessarily saying that too much water is being used by agriculture. So this is an important distinction. They're very supportive of agriculture. There's very little support by our respondents for shifting water from agriculture to urban water use. So that's very important. Despite they think there's too much water being used by residential lawns, but they don't necessarily want to take the water from agriculture to deal with that.
Do people see a connection between climate change and water shortage, and how do they sort of talk about that?
Well, the answer is some do and some don't. When we ask the question about whether or not they're worried about climate change significantly affecting water supplies, we overall, from the respondents, it's fewer than half agree or have concerns about that. That number jumps up to 66% in Salt Lake. But considerably lower in Cache Valley and in Heber Valley and in the farther out areas of the Salt Lake Valley. So that's something that's really varying across different types of places.
Do people have any ideas about what they can do or what can be done in times of water shortage?
Sure. We asked folks if there were a short-term water shortage in their community, what did they think should be done? What were the strategies that they supported? And there was really high support for more education and for voluntary reductions. But I think one of our very interesting findings is that over two-thirds of our respondents supported mandatory restrictions under those circumstances, 67%. In terms of personally, you know, more than half of the respondents, thought that there was more that they could do in their households to conserve water. But interestingly, people are a lot more familiar with how much they spend on water than how much they use. And so that uncertainty about their actual water consumption might be a factor there in what people can actually do.
We've intentionally not been using the word drought, and that's because the survey didn't use the word drought. But this is a program about drought. So I want to talk about drought a little bit. A lot of people have a lot of questions about drought and what it is and what it means and if we should care. And I don't, obviously the household survey that you did not address any of those questions, much to my dismay.
Right. Well, we studied that. That survey was conducted in 2014, and that was a different sort of water year for us. And, now we're in 2015, and people are aware of these changes from year to year. And I think had we been in a different sort of water year, our line of questioning might even been different, and we may have heard some different things from respondents.
So what do you know about drought? What do you know about what people think about drought?
Yeah, so this summer our research has been out working with the public in a very different kind of social science research method. We've been doing public intercept interviews at six different parks that are along the Logan River. We've interviewed over 100 people this summer, the students have. And I have worked through about 84 of those interviews. I'm trying to make sense of them. And it's interesting, over just under two-thirds of our folks interviewed actually mentioned drought or sort of severe water supply issues or shortages. We thought that was pretty interesting. And of those who are mentioning water supply or drought, those responses are sort of split The majority of those respondents talking about drought talk about the need to conserve and do something about this situation. 15 mentioned the California drought in particular. An equal amount mentioned Utah as being in a drought. And then some referred to other states or other countries and issues. So it's definitely on people's minds this summer. They're talking a lot about and actually using the word drought.
What do people feel about our poor friends in California and all of this terrible news that we're hearing about the severity of the drought there?
Yeah, you know, some of the responses are kind of like, oh, that's a bummer for them. It's nice not to be like that. Or it's too bad, but we sure hope it doesn't happen to us. And, you know, some folks talk about, well, we should use that kind of as a warning sign for us. And a quote from someone this summer, they said, "We wouldn't be anything as a human race if we didn't have water. And California is experiencing that right now. We'll see what happens. And yeah, we're going to see what it's like if we don't pay attention."
How do people in Utah sort of, I don't know, maybe know that we're in a drought or know when there are water problems? Like, where you talked about education earlier and how much Utahns sort of value education and want there to be more water education. What's out there right now and are people finding it?
It's interesting. Our respondents aren't talking a whole lot about feeling like they are on the receiving end of a lot of information about drought. That's kind of interesting. A lot of their responses seem to be based on their own personal observations of water levels in different water bodies that they spend time around. Some of them certainly, you know, take notice if there's restrictions for them or for others. And some mentioned the coverage in the news. One respondent who said, "I know that we've had rations in the past when we can water and different things. And I think, you know, it's a good idea. I mean, we at our home, we try not to water like every 3 or 4 days just to make sure. In fact, my husband said the other day, I'm going to turn down the amount of water or amount of time down so the grass can get used to being in a drought." So there is a connectedness here, folks trying to make some adjustments.
And do people feel like their lives are being affected? So it seems like you can do things like maybe let your lawn go a little bit brown. But is that considered an impact? You know, do people feel like it's not ruining their lives, but affecting their lives in some way?
We hear people talk about that, but almost in a little bit of an uncertain terms. They feel like they should be doing something. They're not quite sure whether it'll make a difference or how much they should do. I think that despite the fact that there are lots of educational efforts out there to inform folks, I think that what we're hearing from folks is that they could probably use some more information to help them make decisions. Sometimes we have the tendency to problematize the situation. So we're coming at it from a water shortage or a water, you know, protecting water quality kind of standpoint and really looking into the future. And that's well and good and probably warranted. This summer, as we're talking to folks, it's been striking how, you know, over 2/3 of our respondents, when we ask them, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of water? Overwhelmingly, it's water's vital to life. It's fantastic. Isn't it wonderful what water can do for you and how important it is for your health? It hydrates me. It sustains my family. It's lots of fun. 96% or more of our respondents this summer said that they recreate in some way with water. It's important to their daily lives, their quality of life. And so it's been nice to kind of flip the scientific model and open up the conversation and let people bring in their own relationships with water into the equation. I just close with one quote. Maybe there's this person really kind of captured the essence of all of our interviews. He said, and speaking about water, "It's vital to our existence. It's a lifeblood. Water is important for life, obviously, for our survival. But it's also a great amenity. I mean, we recreate in it. We enjoy it by just looking at it, sitting by the stream or swimming in the river, or swimming in the lake. I mean, it's just something that comes with nature."
Courtney Flint, she's a natural resource sociologist who studies water and has really great information about what Utahns think about water, what's on their minds. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Courtney Flint has been conducting actual scientific surveys about people and water. At Utah Public Radio, we've been conducting a very non-scientific survey asking people if drought has changed any aspect of their lives. We do this to collect stories rather than data. And combined with what we know from studies like Flint's, these can yield powerful insights. People don't necessarily need to be told there's a drought. They notice when things are drier. They observe the effects drought has on their yards and their surroundings. One respondent to the UPR drought survey noticed something in particular about this year's drought. He's been traveling to all of Utah's state parks this summer and noticed that water levels at some lakes and reservoirs in particular were changing how people were recreating. I met up with him at Hiram State Park, just south of Logan, to ask him about what he was seeing. On one of the cooler days we've had this summer in northern Utah, people are still enjoying the water at Hiram State Park. The drought hasn't fully reached Cache County yet, and there's no bathtub ring around the reservoir at Hiram like at Lake Powell. It's full enough for all kinds of boating. People are water skiing, canoeing, trying out stand-up paddleboarding. You'd have to work pretty hard to remind people here that this man-made lake wasn't here purely for their enjoyment on a day like today. But when Ted Hallisey looks out at the water, he doesn't see just a canvas for recreation. He sees water for drinking and growing food.
That everybody loves to get out and recreate, but when I've talked to the managers of the state parks and the rangers have made it clear that most of the state parks obviously are designated as reservoirs for agricultural purposes first. Some of them actually send some of the water down for drinking water. So those are the priorities, and recreation is the secondary benefit of those parks.
Hallisey is better known as Cowboy Ted, a name he got in a previous life when he was a rodeo announcer. Now he's the host of Utah Skyline Recreation, a daily radio report on Utah state parks. He's been to 23 of the state's 43 parks so far, where he interviews park managers and tells listeners what they can do and expect at each park. Hallisey noticed this year that the water level at parks with lakes or reservoirs was becoming a critical part of his recreation reports.
Talked to the manager and the assistant manager over at the Great Salt Lake Marina and the harbor master, and they've already had to pull out several hundred sailboats that have those rudders that can't make it through the canal that leads out of the marina.
Earlier this year, the state legislature set aside $3 million to dredge the marinas at Utah Lake and the Great Salt Lake. Water levels were so low in those places before spring runoff that a lot of boats were on their way to being grounded. The bigger sailboats were already lifted out of their slips in April, and the dredging would be for smaller sailboats and powerboats as water levels drop over the summer. The managers at Willard Bay State Park told Hallisey that the water will be used up for irrigation, and by late summer, powerboats probably won't be able to launch from that marina either. Hallisey lets listeners know about lake levels because it can change people's summer plans.
We're trying to inform people of how much activity they can still do, what kind of different things. Obviously, it makes a lot more sense to do the non-motorized, because a stand-up paddleboard or a kayak and those you can launch from pretty much anywhere. So you can launch those from the beach. So those, I've been told, will be operational throughout the season and into the fall with no impact to the non-motorized. However, some of the boats in Utah Lake are probably going to be limited toward the end of the season unless they're able to dredge that in July or August rather than September or October.
Cowboy Ted started Utah Skyline Recreation to encourage people, especially kids, to get outside and get active. He has a master's degree in physical education, and his foundation is geared towards teaching kids to make healthy lifestyle choices. But after visiting Utah state parks this summer, he shifted his focus to include water conservation.
This is Cowboy Ted, host of the Utah Skyline Recreation Report, asking for your help in conserving water this summer to extend the recreation season and to protect our access to drinking water. Several Utah state parks feature.
He told me he's not worried about drought in Utah, but that he wants to stay informed and help his listeners make informed decisions when they recreate.
A lot of these state parks actually feed the drinking water sources. Obviously, it's purified after the people recreate in it, but it's definitely a lifeline for everybody that's in Utah. And with drought conditions, it doesn't take a big effort for us to do our part.
Robert Gillies mentioned that one way to study the paleoclimate is through tree rings from ancient trees. Another way is to study ancient people. The sources Ross Chambliss spoke with archaeologists and anthropologists who are piecing together clues for how people 1,000 years ago coped with drought in what we now call Utah.
Unless you're a huge fan of archaeology or you're an archaeology student at the University of Utah, you've probably never heard of Larry Coates.
What I do, basically, research-wise, is paleoecology, which means using ecological relationships to reconstruct the conditions of the past.
Coates is one of a handful of scientists researching the Range Creek site, located in the Book Cliffs of Utah's Emery County. It's basically the state's gem for archaeological research. For nearly six decades, the area and its treasures were kept a secret as a private ranch until its owner turned the place over to the state. When he finally did, around 2001, archaeologists were flabbergasted. The ruins left behind there by a band of Fremont Indians nearly 1,000 years ago were amazingly well-preserved, untouched, really, and extensive. A few years back, Larry Coates and others were featured in a PBS series called Time Team America about the Range Creek Project. In it, Coates showed off some of his skills as a technical rock climber.
We're pretty much all rigged up here. Larry's gonna go down. And you'll hear a scream. I'll be on my way down.
Oh, wow.
If you haven't seen this show online, you should really check it out. Anyway, you could think of Coates as a rock-climbing Indiana Jones. He's one of these guys who can look up at the red, high-rising sandstone cliffs and see things that normal people can't see. Things like hidden food storage ruins that the Fremont built to blend into the rock face. Coates has surveyed many of these sites that are thousands of feet high.
What they are primarily are granary structures, so they're storage structures that are built in some very spectacular cliff sites. They didn't build really fine masonry structures. What they tended to do was just kind of shape rocks very basically and then slather a lot of mud in between. And so when you consider the fact that some of these sites are, you know, 1,800, 2,000 feet above the valley floor, the effort involved in getting the mud from the creek, which is where it would have come from, the water from the creek, up to these sites, how many baskets of mud that would have been, how much effort that would have been is extraordinary. It plus then the difficulty of having to climb into a cliff face and basically structure the whole thing, engineer the whole thing there in that place. So quite remarkable in that regard.
Coates and his colleagues have determined that there were different types of granaries. Some were made easily viewable from the bottom, perhaps so a small number of people could keep an eye on them, lest a bandit try climbing up to steal their food. But another class of cliff granaries were designed to be well hidden, even invisible to everyone except the ones who built them. Still, the question of why the Fremont made so many of these so-called high sites for storing food has long intrigued archaeologists. Why make your food so hard to reach? For a long time, Coates says, the assumption was that a prolonged drought, sometime around the mid-1100s, caused a food scarcity, which led to stealing, then hoarding, then fighting and bloodshed, and ultimately the collapse and disappearance of groups like the Fremont from the Colorado Plateau. But Coates suggests the story is probably not that simple.
Yeah, that really probably applies most accurately to the Four Corners groups, because there the old kind of paradigm had been that the Chaco and the two Chacoan droughts hit, and the first one set them back, and the second one drove them away. And now that we have more detailed dendro records from the Southwest, we understand that actually they had been through some very significant droughts, and the severity of the final drought before abandonment of the Colorado Plateau was not really as significant as we thought in the past.
In other words, Coates says, there must have been other things going on as well, perhaps social factors along with the environmental factors. A growing dendrochronological record has sharpened understanding of past hydrologic conditions. Now scientists say 1,000 years ago, things weren't too different from today, meaning there were cycles of long dry periods and cycles of relative wet periods. Knowing this, archaeologists in Range Creek have begun experimenting with ancient farming methods to see how the Fremont may have coped with times of drought. Here in this chilled artifact storage room at the Utah Natural History Museum in Salt Lake City, I met Shannon Arnold Boomgarden, who's been spending much of her time at Range Creek.
Here's some of our corn that we've found, probably close to 100 cobs at different sites throughout the canyon.
Wow.
Preserved on the surface. This one's on a stick, so they were probably drying it. They bundle them up and dry them to go into the granaries.
Boomgarden has been growing her own corn at Range Creek for the last several years. She only uses the types of tools they know the Fremont would have used. Her goal has been to see if the Fremonts would have needed to irrigate to have grown sufficient yields of maize to survive year to year.
And they probably were processing seeds too. We're doing experiments where we're processing and collecting seeds as well. So it's like the other end of the, should we forage or should we farm? And so there's evidence of like winnowing baskets and things like that. And we're getting really great returns on Indian rice grass.
Really?
Yeah. And it's been, we think, just because normally we don't get such high returns, we think this year it was early May rain made the rice grass just go crazy.
Really?
And so we've been getting off the charts yields, like so good you'd probably be like, I'm not going to dig a ditch. I'm going to go process rice grass, see if you can get enough of that to feed your family for a year.
Much of Boomgarden's experimental work assesses whether foraging, or at least dry farming, could have been effective instead of irrigating. Given all the Fremont had to dig ditches for moving water around were sticks and rocks as archaic tools, this would have been a lot of work.
And that's why we keep doing this over and over and over. I mean, one year you can't grow with precip that you got, maybe this year we will.
So far, Boomgarden's research at Range Creek is leading her and her colleagues to think that the Fremont were much more clever with water than we ever gave them credit for. Again, here's Larry Coates.
Irrigation is something that has been largely considered in the archaeological literature as something that's just too demanding to for prehistoric peoples to ever have engaged in, unless for very special cases like the Ho'okam down in the Gila and Salt Valleys, where they had these huge valleys and huge areas could be irrigated. Everywhere else, it was felt to be too much effort to be involved. But we're getting some very different sorts of information now about irrigation. We think that probably the Fremont widely used irrigation. And again, the question is, what does the irrigation get you? And if it gets you reliable crops, then it's worth the effort, or it could be worth the effort if it were the right amount of effort put into it. So that's something that's definitely evolving.
The more you learn about the Fremont, the more respect you have for them. They must have been a tough group of people. They lived hardscrabble lives in a harsh, unforgiving environment. It was really similar to the environment that we live in now. On the other hand, Coates says they were not facing a rapidly changing climate as we are.
We've had episodes of quite dry and quite wet without needing to throw climate change into the mix. The one difference, and something that I really would like to stress about climate change, is that what we're looking at today by raising temperatures a little bit is you're not only looking at dry droughts, you're looking at hot droughts. And that increases the evapotranspiration component of that, which is much worse than just dry droughts, if you kind of gather that. So what we could be looking at is a new style of drought that we've basically never seen before.
The crew at Range Creek will no doubt continue to uncover answers from below the dust and from the seams of the canyon walls. They're also likely to unearth more mysteries. But as far as the lessons to take away from the Fremont of 1,000 years ago, it may be that when dry times come around and stick around, things can get pretty nasty. As the Fremont observed their perennial streams drying up year after year and the rains falling less and less, one could imagine they reacted much how we might react, calling on everyone to conserve, thinking up new technologies and innovations, and hoping and praying that things will get better. Ultimately, Coates says, water today remains as basic as it was 1,000 years ago.
Really, the water that we have is the water that we're going to be using, and that's going to be precipitation. That's going to be any storage that we can possibly capture and hold that water in, which is harder and harder in open reservoirs and in warmer conditions. And as such, we just need to value every drop. And again, the biggest lesson from the prehistoric record, I would say, is that I have no doubt that the Fremont valued every drop of water. And I think we need to adopt a similar sort of valuation.
For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
The Source is produced at the studios of Utah Public Radio, a service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water, water expertise at its source. Major support for The Source comes from iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education. I'm your abnormally dry host, Jennifer Pemberton. I always take Bennett Purser for granted. He makes sure the show goes out on the airwaves where it belongs. I'd label him moderate drought, definitely still a threat. Covering much of the map with his D3 severe drought is producer Ryan Cunningham, whose impacts can be felt throughout the program. Ross Chambliss is a reporter and his own producer. He shows up as that hellish maroon color because we all know he is D4, exceptional drought. We'll be back with a new episode of The Source next month. Whether it's wetter or drier remains to be seen, but we'll be at our new time slot, 10 a.m., still the last Friday of the month, but when more of you are awake. And with a repeat at 3 p.m. the following Saturday. Talk to you then. Thank you for listening.